concerning the animals fit for sacred rites, and what the kinds of sacrifices are. Of the animals used for sacred rites, some are land animals and some travel through the air. Passing over the countless tribes of birds, he chose only two out of all of them, the dove and the turtle dove, because the dove is the tamest of those creatures that are by nature tame and gregarious, while the turtle dove is the tamest of the solitary ones. As for the countless herds of land animals, whose very number is not easy to find, passing over the rest, he selected three by preference: cattle, sheep, and goats, for these are the tamest and most manageable. Indeed, great herds of cattle, flocks of sheep, and droves of goats are led by any chance person, not only a grown man, but even quite a small child, both going out to pasture, and when it is time, returning again in order to their folds. Of their tameness, there are many other signs, but these are the clearest: that they all feed on grass, and none of them eats flesh, and that they have neither hooked claws nor a complete set of teeth, for the upper jaw grows no teeth in front, but only those cutting teeth that are lacking there. Besides this, they are also the most useful of animals for life. Rams provide wool for clothing, the most necessary covering of the body. Oxen serve to plow the earth, to prepare it for sowing, and to thresh the resulting crop so that it may be shared in and enjoyed as food. While the hair and hides of goats, woven and stitched together, have become portable dwellings for travelers, especially for those on campaign, whom necessity often compels to spend much of their time outdoors, away from any city. All must be whole, unblemished in any part of the body, entirely sound throughout, without share and defect. So great, indeed, is the forethought exercised, not only by those who bring the sacrifices, but also by the priests, that the most highly esteemed of the priests, chosen by preference for the task of examining for blemishes, search from head to the very tips of the feet, both what is visible and what is hidden beneath the belly and thighs, lest some slight defect escape notice. This exactness and superabundance of examination is undertaken not for the sake of the animals being sacrificed, but for the blamelessness of those who offer the sacrifice. For the law wishes to teach them, through symbols, that whenever they approach the altars, whether to pray or to give thanks, they should bring no infirmity, disease, or passion upon the soul, but should strive to sanctify it wholly and entirely without stain, so that God, seeing it, may not turn away. Since some sacrifices are offered on behalf of the whole nation, or rather, to speak the truth, on behalf of the whole human race, while others are offered on behalf of each individual who wishes to perform a sacred rite, we must first speak of the common ones. Wonderful is their order. Some are offered every single day, others on the seventh days, others at new moons and sacred months, others at fasts, and others at the three seasons of the festivals. Every day, then, it is prescribed that two lambs be offered, one at dawn and the other in the late evening, each in thanksgiving, the one for the mercies of the day, the other for the mercies of the night, which God unceasingly and without interruption supplies to the human race. On the sevenths, he doubles the number of victims, adding equal to equal, considering the seventh day to be of equal honor to eternity, which he also recorded as the birthday of the whole world. For this reason, he intended the sacrifice of the seventh day to be made equal to the continuity of the daily lambs. Twice each day, the most fragrant of all incenses is burned within the veil, at sunrise and at sunset, before the morning sacrifice and after the evening one, so that the blood offerings serve as thanksgiving on behalf of us who have blood, while the incense offerings serve on behalf of the ruling faculty, the rational spirit within us, which was shaped after the archetypal form of the divine image. Loaves of bread are set out on the sevenths upon the sacred table, equal in number to the months of the year, in two rows of six each, corresponding to the reckoning of the equinoxes, for there are two in every year, the spring and the autumn equinox, each reckoned by 6 months. For this reason, at the spring equinox, all sown crops come to full growth, at the time when the trees begin to bear, while at the autumn equinox, the fruit of the trees is brought to completion, and at that same season, sowing begins again. Thus nature, running the long course of eternity, exchanges one gift for another for the human race, of which the two rows of six loaves set out are symbols. They also hint at the most beneficial of virtues, self-control, which is escorted by frugality, contentment, and the desire for little. on account of the most harmful assault mounted by intemperance and greed. For bread is the lasting nourishment for the lover of wisdom, providing bodies free of disease and a reasoning faculty that is healthy, and above all, sober. Whereas delicacies and honey cakes and seasonings, and all that the elaborate skill of bakers and cooks contrives to bewitch the unrefined, unphilosophical, and utterly servile sense of taste, serving no fine sight or sound, but only the desires of the wretched belly, often produce incurable diseases of body and soul. Together with the loaves are placed frankincense and salt, the frankincense as a symbol that, in the judgment of wisdom, no seasoning is more fragrant than the desire for little and self-control, and the salt as a symbol of the preservation of all things, for the things that are seasoned with it are kept preserved and of a sufficient relish. I know that people occupied with banquets and feasts, who chase after extravagant tables, those wretched slaves to birds and fish and meats and similar nonsense, who cannot even taste true freedom in a dream, will make this a subject of laughter and mockery. But those who have resolved to live according to God and for the pleasure of the truly existent need give little thought to such people. Trained to disregard the pleasures of the flesh, they pursue instead the joys and good states of the mind, exercised in the contemplation of nature. Having ordained these things concerning the seventh day, he says that on the new moons 10 whole burnt offerings must be sacrificed in all, 2 bull calves, 1 ram, 7 lambs. For since the month is complete when the moon completes its own cycle, he deemed it right that a complete number of animals be offered in sacrifice. 10 is a perfect number, which he distributed carefully among what has been said. The 2 bull calves, since the moon has 2 motions as it perpetually runs its double course, one of waxing until it is full, the other of waning until conjunction. The 1 ram, since there is one single principle by which it waxes and wanes through equal intervals, both when it is being lit and when it is failing. And the 7 lambs, because it undergoes its complete transformations in periods of 7 days, in the first week from conjunction, the half moon, in the second, the full moon, and when it turns back again, first to the half moon, and then it comes to an end at conjunction. Along with the victims, he prescribes bringing fine flour soaked in oil, and wine for libations, in fixed measures, because these two are brought to completion by the cycles of the moon through the yearly seasons, which especially ripen the crops. And grain, wine, and oil, the substances most beneficial to life and most necessary for human use, are fittingly consecrated together with all the sacrifices. To the sacred month, a double offering is fittingly brought, since there is also a double account of it, one as a new moon, the other as a sacred month. As a new moon, it has been ordained that the same offerings be sacrificed as on the other new moons. But as a sacred month as well, the gifts are doubled, except for the bull calves, for one is brought instead of 2, since the arbiter judged it right to use, at the beginning of the year, the indivisible nature of the unit rather than the divisible pair. In the first season, and he calls the spring season and the equinox the first season, having prescribed that a 7-day festival be kept, called the Festival of Unleavened Bread, he made all the days equal in honor as regards the sacrifices. For he commands that the same 10 whole burnt offerings be sacrificed each day as on the new moons, apart from the offerings for transgression, amounting in all to 70. For he thought that the 7 days of the festival held the same relation to the new moon month as the equinox, which occurs in the 7th month, holds to it, so that he might show both the beginning of each month to be sacred, and the days equal in number to the new moons taken all together as 7. In the middle of spring, the harvest begins, at which time thank offerings are brought up to God of the plain for having borne its fruit to fullness and for the ingathering of the crops. And a festival most public of all is kept, called, fittingly, the Festival of First Fruits, from what actually happens, since then the first of the produce, the first fruits, are consecrated. It is prescribed to bring as sacrifices 2 bull calves, 1 ram, and 7 lambs, these 10 victims as whole burnt offerings, and 2 lambs for the priests to eat, which he calls offerings of deliverance, because human food has been preserved safe from many and varied dangers of destruction. For ruin is accustomed to overtake crops, sometimes through excessive rain, sometimes through drought, sometimes through other countless disturbances, and sometimes through man-made calamities, when enemies undertake to ravage their neighbor's land by invasion. It is fitting, then, that thank offerings for deliverance be brought up to him who has scattered all such plots, offerings brought up together with loaves of bread, which they bring to the altar and lift up toward heaven, and then distribute to the priests along with the meat of the deliverance offering for a most sacred feast. When the third season arrives, in the seventh month at the autumn equinox, at its beginning a sacred month is kept, called the Festival of Trumpets, of which I spoke earlier. And on the tenth day comes the fast, which is earnestly observed not only by those who are zealous for piety and holiness, but also by those whose whole life is otherwise entirely without reverence. For all, overcome by the sanctity surrounding it, are struck with awe, and even the worst sort then at least vie with the better in self-restraint and virtue. The dignity of the day has a double account, one as of a festival, the other as of purification and flight from sins, for which amnesty is granted by the favor of a merciful God, who honors repentance as equal to not having sinned at all. The sacrifices as of a festival he made equal in number to those of the sacred months. A bull calf, a ram, and seven lambs, blending the unit with the seven and directing the end back toward the beginning, for seven has been allotted as the completion of works, and the unit as the beginning. And the sacrifices as of purification, for he prescribes that two goats and a ram be brought, and then says that one goat must be wholly burned, while the he-goats are to be allotted by lot. And the one that falls to God is to be sacrificed, while the other is to be sent away into a trackless and untrodden wilderness, bearing on itself the curses laid upon those who transgressed, who through their change for the better have been purified, washing away their old lawlessness with new right conduct. On the 15th day, when the moon is full, the festival called Tabernacles is kept, during which the provisions of sacrifices are more numerous. For over the 7 days there are sacrificed in all 70 bull calves, 14 rams, and 98 lambs, all as whole burnt offerings. It has also been prescribed to regard the 8th day as sacred, concerning which precision must be given when the whole account of the festivals is examined, on which the same offerings are brought as on the sacred months. The common whole burnt offerings on behalf of the nation, or more properly speaking on behalf of the entire human race, have now been described to the best of my ability. Alongside the whole burnt offerings, on each day of the festival there also accompanies a he-goat, which is called the offering for sin, and is sacrificed for the remission of transgressions, whose meat is allotted to the priests for food. What, then, is the reason for this? Is it not that a festival is a time of gladness? And true gladness, gladness according to reality, is wisdom firmly established in the soul, and one cannot attain unwavering wisdom without healing of one's transgressions and the excision of the passions. For it would be absurd that each of the animals offered as a whole burnt offering should be found unblemished and unharmed before being consecrated, while the mind of the one sacrificing has not been purified in every way and made bright through washings and sprinklings, which the right reason of nature pours, through healthy and uncorrupted ears, upon souls that love God. In addition to this, the following point might also fittingly be made. These festive relaxations and periods of truce have already, on countless occasions, opened up innumerable paths to sin. For unmixed wine and gluttonous feasting, arousing the belly's insatiable desires, further inflame the desires below the belly as well. And, flowing and pouring out in every direction, produce a flood of countless evils, since they have the fearless license of the festival as their base of operations and a refuge for suffering no consequence. Perceiving this, he did not permit people to keep festival in the same manner as others do, but at the very time of gladness, he first commanded them to keep themselves pure, curbing their impulses toward pleasure. Then he called them into the sanctuary to share in hymns and prayers and sacrifices, so that from the place itself, and from what is seen and said, through the most authoritative senses, sight and hearing, they might come to love self-restraint together with piety. And then, above all, he reminded them not to sin, through the sacrifice for sin. For the one who asks for amnesty for what he has done wrong is not so wretched in spirit as to commit further new offenses at the very time he is asking release from his old wrongs. Having discoursed at such length on these matters, he begins to divide the kinds of sacrifices, and cutting them into three highest classes, he calls the one the whole burnt offering, the second the deliverance offering, and the third the offering for sin. Then he adorns each with what is fitting, aiming, not without care, at what is both proper and free of impurity. The division is altogether excellent and fitting to the matters at hand, having sequence and coherence. For if one wished to examine precisely the reasons for which the first human beings decided to come to thanksgivings together with supplications through sacrifices, one would find two supreme reasons. One, the honor due to God, rendered for his own sake alone, and for no other reason, as a necessary good. The other, that which chiefly concerns those who sacrifice, and this is twofold, one for sharing in good things, the other for release from evils. To the honor rendered according to God and for his sake alone, the law assigned the fitting sacrifice, the whole burnt offering, which brings nothing of mortal self-love, being whole and complete for what is whole and complete. But as for gratitude toward men, since this notion admitted of division, he himself, defining the sacrifice for sharing in good things, named it the deliverance offering, and assigning to the flight from evils the offering for sin, so that there are rightly three offerings corresponding to three purposes, the whole burnt offering for God alone himself, whom it is right to honor, and for no other reason. The others for our own sake, the deliverance offering for the safety and improvement of human affairs, and the offering for sin for the healing of what the soul has done wrong. We must now speak of what has been legislated concerning each, beginning with the best. The best, he says, is, first, that the victim be male, chosen out from among the animals as the finest of its kind, a bull calf or a lamb, and the one bringing it, having washed his hands, is to lay them upon the head of the victim. And after this, one of the priests is to take it and slaughter it, and another, holding out a bowl and receiving the blood, is to go around the altar and sprinkle it on every side. And the victim, having been flayed, is to be divided into whole limbs, the belly and the feet being washed. Then the whole is to be handed over to the sacred fire on the altar, having become many from one and one from many. This is what the express command contains. But another meaning is also indicated, one carrying a riddling account expressed through symbols, and symbols are the visible things spoken, of things unseen and hidden. The whole burnt offering victim is immediately made male, since the male is more complete than the female, more governing, and more akin to the active cause. For the female is incomplete, subordinate, and characterized more by being acted upon than by acting. This is what the explicit command contains. But another meaning is also indicated, one that speaks an enigmatic message through symbols. For what has been stated openly are symbols of things hidden and unseen. The whole burnt sacrificial victim is male from the start, since the male is both more perfect and more commanding than the female, and more akin to the active cause. For the female is imperfect, subordinate, and characterized by being acted upon rather than by acting. Our soul is composed of two elements, the rational and the irrational. The rational belongs to the male line, and it is this that has been allotted mind and reasoning. The irrational belongs to the side of women, and it is this that has received sense perception as its portion. Mind stands to sense perception as a husband to a wife, superior in kind as a whole. And mind, when it is without blemish and purified by the purifications of perfect virtue, is itself the most acceptable sacrifice, pleasing to God wholly and in every part. The laying of hands upon the head of the animal turns out to be a perfectly clear token of blameless actions and of a life that brings nothing liable to accusation, but is in harmony with the laws and ordinances of nature. For the law wishes, first, that the mind of the one sacrificing be consecrated, trained in good and profitable judgments, and next, that his life be composed of the best actions, so that at the very moment of the laying on of hands, he may be able, speaking freely out of a clean conscience, to say something like this. These hands have taken no gift for unjust ends, have had no part in distributions gained by plunder or greed, have not touched innocent blood. They have brought about no maiming, no outrage, no wound, no violence, have served nothing whatsoever that carries blame or reproach, but have become the ministers of all that is good and beneficial, all that is honored among wisdom and laws and wise and law-abiding men. The blood is poured all around the altar, because the circle is the most perfect of shapes, and because no part of the soul's libation should be left destitute and empty, for, properly speaking, blood is the libation of the soul. Symbolically, then, it teaches the understanding to display, in a circling dance around the whole of itself, its pleasing of God in every kind of word, purpose, and deed. It is prescribed, quite symbolically, that the belly and the feet be washed. By the belly is intimated desire, which it is profitable to wash clean, since it is full of stains and pollutions, of drunkenness and drunken violence, an evil most harmful when it is fostered and cultivated to the ruin of human life. By the washing of the feet is meant that one should no longer walk upon the earth, but tread the upper air. For the soul that loves God truly leaps up from earth to heaven, and, taking wing, roams the heights, longing to fall into rank and to dance together with the sun and the moon and the most sacred and perfectly harmonious host of the other stars, under the command and leadership of God, who holds the unchallenged and inalienable kingship through which all things are justly governed. The distribution of the animal into its members shows either that all things are one, or that all proceed from one and return to one, what some have called satiety and want, others conflagration and ordering anew. Conflagration, according to the mastery of heat when it prevails over the other elements. Ordering anew, according to the equal distribution among the four elements, which they exchange with one another. To my mind, on a more accurate view, this is what is shown. The soul that honors being for the sake of being itself must honor it not irrationally or ignorantly, but with knowledge and reason. The account concerning God admits of division and distinction according to each of the divine powers and virtues, for God is good, and is the maker and begetter of all things, and provident over what he has begotten, and savior and benefactor, filled with blessedness and every happiness, each of which qualities is itself venerable and praiseworthy, both taken alone and examined together with its kindred qualities. The same holds for the rest. Whenever you wish, O understanding, to give thanks to God for the coming to be of the cosmos, you should offer your thanksgiving both for the whole and for its most comprehensive parts, as though for the limbs of the most perfect living creature. I mean heaven and sun and moon, the wandering and the fixed stars, then earth and the animals and plants upon it, then seas and rivers, both those fed from their own springs and the winter torrents, and the creatures in them. And then air and the changes that occur in it for winter and summer, spring and autumn, the yearly seasons most beneficial to life, are conditions of the air as it turns, for the preservation of all that lies beneath the moon. And if ever you give thanks concerning human beings, do not give thanks only for the race as a whole, but also for its kinds and its most essential parts, men, women, Greeks, barbarians, those on the continents, those allotted the islands. And if it is for a single man, divide your thanksgiving by reason, not down to the finest details, all the way to the last particulars, but into the most fundamental components. Body and soul first, of which he is composed, and then reason, mind, and sense perception, for thanksgiving for each of these, taken by itself, could never be unworthy of God's hearing. Let this suffice as said concerning the whole burnt sacrifice. Next, we must examine the sacrifice called the peace offering. In this case, it makes no difference whether the victim is male or female. Once it has been slaughtered, three parts are set aside for the altar: the fat, the lobe of the liver, and the two kidneys. The rest is a feast for the one who has offered the sacrifice. Why these particular internal parts are consecrated must be examined carefully, without passing it by. Reasoning this over with myself many times and searching it out, I was puzzled as to why the law set aside, as first fruits of the animals sacrificed, the lobe of the liver, the kidneys, and the fat, but neither the heart nor the brain, though the ruling faculty resides in one or the other of these. I think that not a few others, too, who approach the sacred writings with the understanding rather than with the eyes, will raise the same question. If then, upon inquiry, they discover a more persuasive reason, they will benefit both themselves and us. But if not, let them weigh the explanation I have devised to see whether it is sound. It is this: of all that is in us, the ruling faculty alone receives and gives room to folly, injustice, cowardice, and the other vices, And the house of this faculty is one or the other of the two organs mentioned, the brain or the heart. The sacred word therefore judged it right not to bring to God's altar, through which release from every sin and transgression comes, and full remission any vessel in which the mind, once having lurked, went astray onto the trackless road of injustice and impiety, turning aside from the road leading to virtue and true nobility. For it would be foolish to make sacrifices a reminder of sins rather than an oblivion of them. This, it seems to me, is the reason why neither of the organs holding the ruling power, brain or heart, is offered. But the parts that are set apart have a fitting rationale. The fat, because it is both the richest part and a guardian of the inner organs, for it wraps and enriches them, and by the softness of its touch does them good. The kidneys, because of the adjacent glands and the organs of generation, next to which they lie like good neighbors, helping and cooperating so that nature's sowing may go forward well, with nothing nearby standing in the way, for the kidneys are themselves blood-colored receptacles, into which the fluid purging of waste matter is separated off, while the glands lie close by, through which the seed is watered. And the lobe of the liver is the first fruit of the most authoritative of the inner organs, through which nourishment is turned into blood and, channeled to the heart, is carried through the veins for the preservation of the whole body. For the gullet, lying next to the passage of swallowing, receives the food already cut by the teeth and ground fine and works on it further, handing it to the belly. The belly, taking over this second service from the gullet, performs the task to which nature has appointed it, reducing the food to chyle. And two pipes, like channels, grow out of the belly and pour it into the liver, into the receptacles formed within it. The liver has a twofold power, one of separation and one for the making of blood. The power of separation sifts off everything hard and indigestible into the neighboring vessel of bile, while the other power turns what is pure and strained, by the heat surrounding it, into the most life-giving blood, and presses it out toward the heart, from which, as has been said, channeled through the veins, it circulates through the whole body, becoming its nourishment. This, too, belongs with what has been said. The liver, being suspended aloft and perfectly smooth, has, on account of that smoothness, the character of a most radiant mirror, so that whenever the mind, withdrawing from the concerns of the day, with the body relaxed in sleep and none of the senses standing in its way, begins to circle back upon itself, and to survey its own thoughts purely by itself, it may, gazing as into a mirror, the liver behold each of the objects of thought with perfect clarity, and, looking all around at the images reflected in a circle, see whether any disgrace attaches to them, so as to flee the one and choose its opposite, and, having taken pleasure in all its visions, may prophesy the future through dreams. The law permits the use of the peace offering for only 2 days, leaving nothing over into the third, for many reasons. One is that everything belonging to the sacred table must be consumed promptly, with care taken that it not spoil through length of time. For the nature of stale meat is quick to putrefy, even if it has been seasoned with spices. Another is that sacrifices ought not to be hoarded, but set out openly for all who are in need. For they no longer belong to the one who sacrificed, but to the one to whom the victim has been sacrificed, who, being a benefactor and generous giver, has made the company of those celebrating the sacrifice partakers of his altar and guests at his own table, and instructs them not to think of themselves as hosts. For they are stewards of the feast, not hosts. The host is the one to whom the provision itself belongs, which it is not right to hide away out of stinginess, an ignoble vice, when one ought to prefer generosity, the mark of noble virtue. The last reason is that the peace offering is brought on behalf of two things, soul and body, and to each of these 1 day was allotted for the feasting on the meat. For it was fitting that an equal span of time be set for those parts of us naturally disposed to be preserved, so that on the first day, together with the eating, one might receive a reminder of the soul's preservation, and on the second, of the body's health. But since there was nothing third that could, properly speaking, receive preservation, the law forbade absolutely the use of it on the third day, ordaining that even if something happened to be left over through ignorance or forgetfulness, it should at once be consumed by fire. It declares the one who tastes of it alone guilty, and says to him, You imagine you have sacrificed, ridiculous man, but you have not sacrificed. I have not accepted these unholy, unconsecrated, profane, unclean meats you have cooked, you glutton, for you have not so much as dreamed of true sacrifices. Included as a species of the peace offering is the one called the offering of praise, whose rationale is this. The person who is met with nothing at all unwanted, neither in body nor in outward circumstance, but leads a life free of struggle and at peace, tested amid comforts and good fortunes, unharmed and unstumbling, steering the long sea of life in fair weather and calm waters, with good fortune ever blowing favorably at the stern. Such a person is bound of necessity to repay, in a manner fitting to piety, with hymns and words of blessing, with prayers, sacrifices, and other acts of thanksgiving. The God who steers him and grants him health and preservation, unharmed benefits, and, in short, good things unmixed with evil, and all these together taken as one, have received the single name praise. So much for that offering. Next in order, we must examine the third kind, which is called the sin offering. It is divided in many ways, both by the persons involved and by the kinds of victims. The persons are the high priest, the whole nation, a ruler acting individually, and a private person. The victims are a bull calf, a male goat, a female goat, or a ewe lamb. A distinction is drawn, and it was above all necessary that it be drawn, between voluntary and involuntary offenses, since those who consider that they have sinned undergo a change for the better, blaming themselves for their transgressions and steering their course toward a blameless life. Now the offenses of the high priest and of the nation are purified by a victim of equal honor, while those of the ruler are purified by a lesser one, though still male, for the victim is a male goat, and those of the private person by a still lower kind, for the sacrifice offered is not a male but a female goat. For it was fitting that the ruler should carry more weight than the private person, even in matters of sacrifice, and the nation more than the ruler, since the whole must always outweigh the part. Yet the high priest was judged worthy of the same privilege as the nation in his purification, and in seeking amnesty for wrongdoing from God's gracious power. This equality of honor he enjoys not so much for his own sake, it seems, as because he is the servant of the nation, offering the common thanksgivings on behalf of all in the most sacred prayers and the most reverent sacrifices. Solemn and wondrous, too, is the ordinance concerning these matters. If, it says, the high priest should sin unwillingly, and it adds, so that the people sin, cf. Lev. 4:3, all but openly teaching that the high priest who is such in truth, and not falsely named, has no part in sins. But if he should ever slip, he will suffer this not on his own account, but through a fault common to the nation. A fault, moreover, that is not incurable but readily admits of healing. When the calf has been slaughtered, he commands that the blood be sprinkled 7 times with the finger opposite the veil before the inner sanctuary, further within than in the previous case, in the place where the most sacred vessels are set. And then that the 4 horns of the incense altar, for it is square, be smeared and anointed, and that the rest of the blood be poured out beside the base of the altar in the open court. Onto this altar, he directs that 3 things be brought up: the fat, the lobe of the liver, and the 2 kidneys, following the same arrangement as for the peace offering. But the hide and the flesh, and the whole of the rest of the calf's body from head to foot together with the entrails, are to be carried outside and burned in a clean place, where it is customary for the sacred ashes to be removed from the altar. He legislates the same procedure also for the case when the whole nation sins. But if a ruler should transgress, purification is made with a male goat, as I said. If a private person, with a female goat or a ewe lamb, for to the ruler he assigned a male animal, to the private person a female. While in all other respects he ordained the same procedure for both. To smear the horns of the altar in the open court with the blood, to bring up the fat, the lobe of the liver, and the 2 kidneys, and to give the rest to the priests for food. Since some offenses are committed against human beings, and others against sacred and holy things, he has already discussed the case of unwilling offenses against human beings. But for the purification of offenses against sacred things, he legislates propitiation by a ram, after the guilty party has first repaid the value of the object in respect of which the wrong was done, adding a fifth part over and above its worth. Having legislated these and similar matters concerning involuntary offenses, he next lays down rules concerning voluntary ones. If someone, he says, lies about a partnership, or a deposit, or something plundered, or something found that another had lost, and having come under suspicion, is put under oath and swears, and though he seems to have escaped conviction by his accusers, becomes his own accuser, convicted within by his own conscience, and blames himself for what he denied and for perjuring himself, and, openly confessing the wrong he committed, asks for forgiveness, he commands that amnesty be granted to such a person, provided he proves his repentance genuine not by promise, but by deed, by restoring the deposit and whatever he plundered or found or in any way appropriated from his neighbor, adding also a fifth part in payment as consolation for the wrong done. And when he has first made propitiation to the one he wronged, let him go, he says, thereafter to the sanctuary as well, to ask forgiveness for his sin, bringing as his advocate the unimpeachable witness within the soul, which has rescued him from an incurable disaster by releasing the deadly disease and restoring him to complete health. For this case, too, the victim prescribed is a ram, just as for the one who has transgressed against sacred things. For the unwilling offense against sacred things, he made equal in value to the willing offense against human affairs. Unless indeed this, too, is in some sense a sacred matter, since an oath has entered into it. An oath which, though it was not made in soundness, he set right again by a turn toward what is better. It should be observed that the parts brought to the altar from the sin offering are the same as in the peace offering, the lobe of the liver, the fat, and the kidneys. For in a sense, the one who repents is also saved, having turned away from the disease of the soul, which is harder to bear than the passions of the body. The remaining parts of the animal are set apart for food, but with a distinct treatment. The difference lies in three things: place, time, and those who receive it. The place is the sanctuary, the time, one day instead of two, and those who share in it are the priests, not those on whose behalf the sacrifice is offered, and among priests, only the males. He does not permit it to be carried outside the sanctuary, wishing that if the repentant person has previously sinned, this should not become notorious, handed over to the ungracious judgments and unbridled tongues of the envious and the quarrelsome for reproach and slander, but should remain within the sacred bounds, where the purification itself has taken place. He commands that the priests feast on the sacrifice for many reasons. First, so that he may honor those who have offered it, for the esteem shown to the guests adds honor to their hosts. Second, so that they may be most firmly persuaded that those into whom remorse for their sins has entered have God gracious toward them, for he would not have called his attendants and servants to share such a table had the amnesty not been complete. Third, because no one is permitted to minister among the priests who is not whole in body, for he is rejected on account of blemish. He thus offers comfort to those who no longer walk the path of wrongdoing, on the ground that, for the sake of belonging to the priestly line, they have received a share in purity of purpose and have been raised to equal honor with the priests. This is why the sin offering, too, is consumed within a single day, since it is fitting that those who are about to sin should always delay and be slow to do so, but that in doing what is right they should act with hastened speed. But the offerings slaughtered on behalf of the high priest or the nation for their transgression are not prepared for food. Instead, they are burned upon the sacred ashes, as has been said. For no one is greater than the high priest or the nation to serve as an intercessor for those who have sinned. It is fitting, then, that the flesh be consumed by fire, in imitation of the whole burnt offerings, out of honor for the persons involved. Not because the sacred judgments are made according to rank, but because the offenses of those who are great in virtue and truly holy are of such a kind as to be reckoned the achievements of others. For just as deep and fertile plowland, even if it should sometimes fail to bear, still yields more fruit than land poor by nature, in the same way it happens that the failures of the good and God-loving in the pursuit of nobility are better than the successes that the base achieve by chance. For these latter cannot endure to do anything sound by deliberate purpose. Having laid down these regulations concerning each kind of sacrifice individually, the whole burnt offering, the peace offering, and the sin offering, He now adds legislation for another kind common to all three, so as to show that these are friendly and akin to one another, and the offering that gathers them together is called the Great Vow. Why it received this name must be explained. When people offer first fruits from every part of their possessions, wheat, barley, oil, wine, the finest of the tree fruits, and then the firstborn males of their animals, consecrating the clean ones and paying the assessed value for the unclean, and having no more material with which to express their piety, dedicate, and consecrate themselves, they display an ineffable holiness and a certain excess of God-loving purpose. That is why it is fittingly called the Great Vow. For the greatest of a person's possessions is one's own self, and this is what he yields up and relinquishes. Having made the vow, he prescribes the following. First, that the person not partake of unmixed wine, nor of anything produced from the grape, nor drink any other intoxicant that would impair the reasoning faculty, considering that time to be a period of priestly service. For even the ministers among the priests, when thirsty, are forbidden anything touching on drunkenness and must quench their thirst with water alone. Second, that he not cut the hair of his head, providing onlookers with a clear symbol that he is not debasing the currency of his vow. Third, that he keep his body clean and undefiled, so as not to go in to his dead parents or brothers, since piety overcomes the natural affection and sympathy toward one's own kin and dearest ones, a victory that it is always good to win, both. When the appointed time has elapsed, the law commands three animals to be brought forward for the release of the vow. A male lamb, a ewe lamb, and a ram, the male lamb for a whole burnt offering, the ewe lamb as a sin offering, and the ram as a sacrifice of salvation. For in all these, the one who made the vow is somehow represented. In the whole burnt sacrifice, because he yields not only the first fruits of other things, but of himself. In the sin offering, because he is human, for even the perfect man, insofar as he is a created being, cannot escape falling into error. And in the sacrifice of salvation, because he has inscribed the true Savior, God, as the cause of his salvation, and not physicians and their powers. For physicians are frail and mortal, unable even to provide health for themselves, and their powers benefit neither everyone nor always the same people, but sometimes even do great harm, since authority over both the powers and those who use them belongs to another. What astonishes me is that, although the three animals are brought forward for different sacrifices, none of them differs in kind. All belong to the same genus, ram, male lamb, and ewe lamb. For the law wishes, as I said a little earlier, to establish through this that the three forms of sacrifice are sisters and kin, since the one who repents is saved, and the one who is saved from the sicknesses of the soul repents, and each hastens toward a whole and complete disposition, of which the whole burnt offering is the symbol. Since he had vowed to offer up himself, but it is not lawful for the sacred altar to be polluted with human blood, and yet some part had absolutely to be consecrated, he was eager to take a part which, when removed, causes neither pain nor disfigurement. For of the plant-like growth of the body, like the superfluous branches of a tree, he shaved off the hair of his head and handed it over to the fire on which the flesh of the sacrifice of salvation is boiled. Fittingly, so that some part belonging to the one who made the vow, which is not permitted on the altar, might at least be mingled in with the sacrifice, becoming fuel for the sacred flame. These, then, are common to all others. But the priests too were required to offer some firstfruits to the altar, so that they would not suppose that the services and ministries to which they had been appointed had won them exemption. The firstfruits fitting for priests come from none of the blood offerings, but from the purest of human food. For their continual sacrifice is fine wheat flour, a tenth of the sacred measure each day, half of it offered in the morning and half in the evening, fried in oil, with none of it left over for eating. For there is an oracle that every sacrifice of a priest must be wholly burnt, and none of it allotted for food. Having spoken, as far as was possible, about sacrifices, we shall next speak about those who offer sacrifice. On those who sacrifice. The law wishes the one who brings sacrifices to be pure in body and soul, the soul pure from passions and diseases and sicknesses and vices in both word and deed, and the body pure from whatever it is customary to be defiled by. He devised the fitting purification for each. For the soul, through the animals prepared for sacrifices as remedies, for the body, through washings and sprinklings, about which we shall speak a little later. For it is right to grant the seat of honor in matters of reason to the better and more governing part within us, the soul. What then is its purification? Look, he says, my friend, at the victim you bring forward, how it is whole and entirely without blemish, judged best from among many by the incorruptible judgment of the priests and by their eyes, sharpened by continual practice, for blameless inspection. For if you do not see this more with your eyes than with your reasoning, you will wash away your sins and all the stains you have contracted throughout your whole life, some by involuntary circumstance, some by deliberate choice. For you will find that such precision concerning the animal hints, through a symbol, at the improvement of your own character. For the law is not concerned with irrational creatures, but with those who possess mind and reason. So it is not the victims that are its care, that they should have no blemish, but those who sacrifice, that they should be sick with no passion. As for the body, as I said, he purifies it with washings and sprinklings, and does not allow one who has been sprinkled or washed once to enter straightway within the sacred precincts. Instead, he commands him to spend 7 days outside and to be sprinkled twice, on the third and seventh days, and after this, once washed, grants him fearless entry and access to the sacred rites. How much foresight and philosophy there is even in this must be examined. Almost all other peoples are sprinkled with unmixed water, most with sea water, some with river water, others drawing it in jars from springs. But Moses, having first prepared ashes left over from a sacred fire, the manner of which will be shown presently, says that one must take from these, and, casting them into a vessel, pour water on top, and then, dipping sprigs of hyssop into the mixture, sprinkle those being purified. The reason for this, one might say, is not beside the point. He wishes those who approach the service of the existing one to know themselves first, and their own being. For how could one ignorant of himself be able to grasp the supreme power of God, which surpasses all things? Our being, as far as the body is concerned, is earth and water, of which he reminds us through the purification, supposing this very thing to be the most beneficial purification. That one should know oneself, and from what things, worthy of no esteem, ash and water, one has been compounded. For once he has recognized this, he will immediately turn away from treacherous self-conceit, and having cast down his arrogance, will be well-pleasing to God, and will exchange his insolence for God's gracious power. For it has been well said somewhere that the one who undertakes haughty words or deeds provokes not only human beings, but also God, the maker of equality and of everything most excellent. Num. 1530, so when they are sprinkled and struck and roused, it is as though the very elements, earth and water, cry out and say, "We are the substance of your body." Nature, blending us by divine art, shaped us into human form, compacted out of us when you came into being, you will again be resolved into us when it is time to die. For nothing that exists is by nature destroyed into non-being, but the end returns to that from which the beginning came. Now it is necessary to redeem the promise concerning the peculiar property of this ash. For it is not merely wood consumed by fire, but also an animal fit for such a purification. For he commands that a red heifer, unyoked and unblemished, be brought and slaughtered outside the city, and that the high priest, taking of its blood, sprinkle it 7 times facing the temple, and then burn the whole of it with its hide, flesh, blood, and belly full of its contents. And as the flame dies down, he commands that 3 things be thrown into the very middle of it: cedar wood, hyssop, and scarlet wool. Then, once it has gone out, a clean man is to gather the ashes and deposit them again outside the city in a clean place. What these things hint at, as through symbols, we have set out precisely elsewhere through allegory. It is necessary that those who are about to frequent the temple to share in sacrifice should brighten both the body and, before the body, the soul. For the soul is mistress and queen and superior in all things, since it has been allotted a more divine nature. What brightens the mind is wisdom, and the doctrines of wisdom that guide one toward contemplation of the cosmos and the things in it, and the sacred choir of the other virtues, and the fine and highly praised actions done in accordance with virtue. Let the man adorned with these things, then, go forward with confidence into the temple most akin to him, the finest dwelling place of all, ready to show himself as the sacrificial victim. But whoever harbors and lies in wait for greed and desires for injustice, let him cover himself and keep his shameless recklessness and excessive boldness quiet, restraining them where caution is profitable. For the sanctuary of the truly existing one is inaccessible to unholy sacrifices. I would say, noble sir, God does not rejoice even if one brings up hecatombs. For all things are his possessions, yet possessing them, he needs nothing. He rejoices in God-loving minds and in men who practice holiness, from whom he gladly receives cakes and barley, and the cheapest offerings as though they were the most precious, ahead of the costliest. And indeed, even if they bring nothing else, but bring themselves as the most perfect fulfillment of nobility, they offer the best sacrifice, honoring the benefactor and Savior God with hymns and thanksgivings, some through vocal instruments, others without tongue or mouth, making their intelligible processions and outcries with the soul alone, of which only the divine ear takes hold, for the hearing of human beings cannot perceive them. That this account is not false, and not mine but nature's own, is attested somehow by clear evidence itself, which offers plain proof to those who do not practice disbelief out of love of contention. And it is attested also by the law, which ordained that two altars be constructed, differing in materials, in locations, and in uses. For the one has been built of unhewn, selected stones, and stands in the open air near the approaches to the temple, and has come to be for the use of blood offerings. The other has been constructed of the purest gold and stands within the inner sanctuary, behind the first curtain, visible to none of the others except the priests who are purified, and has come to be for the use of incense. From this, it is clear that God considers even the smallest grain of frankincense from a holy man more precious than countless herds of cattle, whatever a man not truly noble might sacrifice. For just as, I think, gold is better than random stones, and things within the inner sanctuary are more sacred than those outside, by so much is thanksgiving through incense offerings superior to that through blood offerings. From this, it is clear that God considers even the smallest pinch of frankincense more precious than the sacrifice of countless victims offered by a man who is not truly good. For I think that, just as gold is better than ordinary stones, and the things within the inner sanctuary are holier than those outside it, so by that same measure thanksgiving offered through incense is superior to thanksgiving offered through blood sacrifices. For this reason, the altar of incense is honored not only by the costliness and craftsmanship of its material and by its location, but also by the fact that it is the first to be served each day with the thank offerings that human beings bring to God. For it is not permitted to bring forward the whole burnt offering outside until the incense has been offered within, at deep dawn. And this is a symbol of nothing other than the truth that, in God's sight, it is not the multitude of victims sacrificed that is precious, but the purest rational spirit of the one sacrificing. For if a judge who cares about a holy verdict would not take gifts from one of the parties on trial, or if he took them would be guilty of bribery, nor would a good man take gifts from some wicked person, one human being from another wealthy human being, even if he himself were in need, would you really suppose that God can be bribed? God, who is entirely self-sufficient and in need of nothing that has come into being, who, being the first good, the most perfect, the ever-flowing spring of wisdom and justice and all virtue, turns away the gifts of the unjust. And the one who brings such gifts, is he not the most shameless of all, since he offers, from what he has stolen or seized or denied or taken by fraud, a portion, as though making God a partner in his own wickedness and greed? Most wretched of all men, I would say to such a person, you expect one of two things, either that you will escape notice, or that you will be found out. If you suppose you will escape notice, you are ignorant of God's power, by which he sees all things and hears all things at once. And if you think you will be exposed and still bring the offering, you are utterly reckless. For instead of hiding what you did wrong, as you ought, you bring out into the open the very evidence of the wrongs you have committed, and giving yourself airs, you distribute it to God, bringing him unholy first fruits, without ever reckoning that neither does law admit lawlessness, nor does the light of the sun admit darkness. But God is both the archetypal pattern of laws and the son of the sun, the intelligible son of the sensible one, who from invisible springs supplies visible light to what is seen. M on not bringing the wages of a prostitute into the temple. It is a very fine thing that this too has been inscribed on the sacred tablets of the law, that the wages of a prostitute must not be brought into the sanctuary from a woman who has sold her own bloom of youth, choosing, for the sake of shameful gain, a life open to reproach. But if the gifts from a woman who has played the harlot are unholy, how much more so are the gifts from a soul that has prostituted itself, a soul that has flung itself into shame and the utmost outrages, drunkenness, gluttony, love of money, love of glory, love of pleasure, and countless other forms of passion, sickness, and vice. What length of time could wash away those stains? I, for one, do not know of any. For old age often puts an end to the trade of courtesans, since once they have passed their prime, no one approaches them any longer, their bloom having withered like that of certain flowers. But what age could ever turn the prostitution of a soul, trained and habituated in a licentiousness that has grown up with it, toward good order? No age at all, only God, for whom what is impossible for us is possible. The one who is about to sacrifice must examine, not whether the victim is unblemished, but whether his own understanding is whole and complete in every part. Let him also search out the reasons for which he thinks fit to bring sacrifices, whether he is giving thanks for benefits already received, or asking for the securing of present goods, or the acquisition of future ones, or for the averting of present or expected evils. In all these cases, he must furnish his reasoning with health and soundness. For if he gives thanks for benefits already received, let him not prove ungrateful by becoming base, for favors were given to a person of worth. And if he is seeking confirmation of present goods while hoping for good things to come, let him make himself worthy of good fortune by being a person of true worth. And if he is asking for escape from certain evils, let him not do things deserving of punishments and penalties. Other matters concerning the altar. Fire, it says, shall burn continually on the altar and never be extinguished. And rightly and fittingly so, I think. For since the graces of God are ever flowing, unfailing, and uninterrupted, which human beings receive by day and by night, so too the symbol of thanksgiving, the sacred flame, must be kept alive and never allowed to go out. Perhaps, too, it is his wish, by this means, to join the old sacrifices to the new and unite them through the permanence and presence of the same fire, by which all are consecrated, as a sign that thanksgiving must be complete, whatever the countless occasions from which the offerings come, whether out of abundant plenty or, on the contrary, out of the scarcity of what is brought. These, then, are the literal meaning symbols of things perceived by the intellect, but the matters bearing on the understanding must be examined by the rules of allegory. In truth, the altar of God is the grateful soul of the wise man, established out of complete, undivided, and indivisible virtues, for no part of virtue is useless. On this altar the sacred light is forever kindled, kept unextinguished, and the light of the understanding is wisdom, since the opposite darkness of the soul is folly. For what perceptible light is to the eyes for the apprehension of bodies, knowledge is to reasoning for the contemplation of things incorporeal and intelligible, and its brightness shines forever, never dimmed. After this he says, "Upon every offering you shall bring salt," by which, as I said before, he hints at permanence extending to everything. For salt is a preservative of bodies, honored with second place after the soul. For just as the soul is the cause of bodies not decaying, so too salt, holding bodies together for the greatest length of time, in a certain way makes them immortal. This is why he has called it altar, giving it a name of its own and distinct, evidently derived from its preserving the sacrifices, even though the meat is in fact consumed by fire, so that it is the clearest proof that God supposes the sacrifice to consist not in the victims, but in the understanding and eagerness of the one offering, in which alone lies the stability and firmness that comes from virtue. Moreover, he further legislates, commanding that every sacrifice be brought without leaven and without honey, deeming neither fit to be offered up on the altar. Honey, perhaps, because its producer, the bee, is not a pure creature, being generated, so the account goes, from the decay and corruption of dead oxen, just as wasps are generated from the bodies of horses. Or perhaps it is a symbol that all excessive pleasure is unholy, sweetening what is swallowed but afterward bringing bitter and hard-to-cure pains, by which the soul is inevitably shaken and disturbed, unable to establish itself firmly. And leaven, because of the swelling it produces, again symbolically, so that no one approaching the altar should ever be puffed up, inflated by arrogance, but rather, looking toward the greatness of God, should perceive his own weakness as a created being, even if he surpasses others in good fortune, and, making the fitting calculation, should curb the overweening height of his pride, destroying the treacherous conceit within him. For if the founder and maker of all things, in need of nothing that he has generated, does not look to the excesses of his own power and authority, but to your weakness, and shares with you his gracious power, filling up the deficiencies you suffer from, what is it fitting for you to do toward other people, your kin by nature, sown from the same elements, you who have contributed nothing to the world, not even yourself? For you came naked, marvelous man, and naked again you will depart, having received from God for your use the time between birth and death, in which it was fitting to do nothing other than to attend to fellowship, concord, equality, kindness to your fellow man, and every other virtue, casting away that unequal, unjust, and unsociable vice which makes the gentlest creature by nature, man, savage and untamed. Again, he commands that lamps be kept burning on the sacred lampstand within the veil from evening until morning, for many reasons. One is so that, in succession to the light of day, the holy place, always untouched by darkness, may be illuminated in the likeness of the stars. For these too, when the sun sets, display their own light, never abandoning the position assigned to them in the universe. Another reason is that even by night something akin and related to the daytime sacrifices should be carried out, for God's pleasure, so that no time or occasion for thanksgiving may be left out. And the sacrifice most fitting and most suited to the night for thanksgiving, for it deserves to be called a sacrifice, is the radiance of the most sacred light within the inner sanctuary. A third reason, and a very necessary one. Since we are well cared for not only while awake, but also while asleep, God, in his love of giving, has provided sleep as a great assistance to the mortal race, for the benefit of both body and soul. The body being released from its daytime labors, and the soul being relieved of its cares and withdrawing into itself, away from the crowd and clamor of the senses, able then, at least, to be alone and to converse with itself. It was fitting, then, that the law should apportion thanksgivings accordingly. For waking hours, through the victims that are brought, and for sleep and its benefits, through the kindling of the sacred lamps. These, then, are the things legislated for piety, by way of commands and prohibitions, together with matters like them. But as for what belongs to philosophical instructions and exhortations, this must be said. God, it says, O understanding, asks nothing burdensome, complicated, or difficult of you, but something entirely simple and easy. And this is, to love him as a benefactor, or, failing that, at least to fear him as ruler and lord, and to walk in every path that leads to pleasing him, and to serve him not carelessly but with the whole soul, filled with a disposition devoted to God, and to hold fast to his commandments and to honor justice. As a result of all this, he himself remains in the same unchanging nature, while everything else in the universe attains improvement, sun or moon or the multitude of the other stars or the whole heaven. And of the earth too, the mountains rise to their utmost height, while the plain, like substances that have been poured out, spreads to its greatest breadth, and the sea changes to fresh water, or the rivers become equal in size to the open seas. But no, each of these things is fixed within the same bounds in which it was set from the very beginning when God made it, whereas you will become better by living blamelessly. What then, of all this, is burdensome or laborious? We need not cross unnavigable seas, tossed up and down at the height of winter by the swell and the force of contrary winds, nor tramp rough and untrodden wilds instead of roads, forever cowering before the attacks of bandits or wild beasts, nor keep watch on walls, camping in the open at night, while enemies lie in wait and threaten the gravest dangers. No, let nothing unpleasant be said of what is good. We must speak only well of things that so benefit us. The soul need only give its assent, and everything is at hand ready. Or do you not know that both the sensible heaven and the intelligible heaven belong to God, the intelligible heaven being, one might properly say, the heaven of heaven, and likewise the earth and everything in it, and the whole cosmos, both the visible and the invisible and incorporeal, the model of the visible heaven. Yet even so, from the whole human race he chose out, by merit, those who are truly human, and judged them worthy of every privilege, calling them to the service of himself, the ever-flowing fountain of good things, from which he also rained down the other virtues and poured them out for the most beneficial enjoyment. A draught that makes immortal no less than, or even more than, nectar. Pitiable and unfortunate are all who have not feasted on the drink of virtue, and most unfortunate of all are those who have never once tasted nobility of character, when it was possible to rejoice and delight in justice and holiness. Instead, they are uncircumcised in heart, as the law says, and through the hardness of their disposition are rebellious, kicking willfully and stiffening their necks. Them he admonishes, saying, "Circumcise the hardness of your heart." Deut. 10:16. That is, cut away with all diligence the excess growths of the ruling faculty, which the unmeasured impulses of the passions have sown and made to flourish, and which folly, that evil farmer of the soul, has planted. And let your neck, he says, not be stiff, that is, let the mind not be unbending and utterly self-willed, nor let it cultivate, out of excessive obstinacy, the most harmful ignorance. Rather, having laid aside its naturally difficult and intractable temper as an enemy, let it change over to gentleness, in obedience to the laws of nature. Or do you not see that the first and greatest of the powers surrounding being are the beneficent and the punitive? And the beneficent has been called God, since it was by this power that he established and ordered the universe, while the other is called Lord, since by it he holds fast the mastery over all things. And God is God not only of men but also of gods, and ruler not only of private persons but also of rulers, being truly great and mighty and powerful. And yet he who is so great in virtues and powers takes pity and compassion on those most destitute in their want, not disdaining to become a judge for converts, orphans, or widows, but looking past kings and tyrants and those in great positions of power, he deems worthy of his providence the lowliness of the ones just named. For converts, for this reason, having left behind the ancestral ways in which they were reared, ways full of false fictions and vanity, and having become genuine lovers of truth free from vanity, they have moved over to piety, being suppliants and worshippers of the truly existent, worthy as they are, they receive a fitting share of providence, finding as the fruit of their taking refuge in God the help that comes from him. For orphans and widows, since they have been deprived of their protectors, the former of parents, the latter of husbands, and no refuge from among men remains for those left so utterly alone. Therefore they are not without a share in the greatest hope, that of God, who, because of his gracious nature, does not turn away his providence and care from those so bereft.